Hello. It's December 22nd, 2024. My name is Simone, and this is a special edition of 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to this brand new special edition episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. And why is this edition? Well, this episode a special edition? Well, today's episode is the finale of Season 5 of 90s Crime Time. After dragging it for over a year, Season 5 is finally coming to a close. And you might have heard of this story, but I wanted to bring it to you anyway, since it took place during the holiday season. And I'll go ahead and warn you that it has to deal with child abuse, suicide attempts, and other abuse, and it's very graphic. So listener's discretion is advised. And with this, let's dive in to the Season 5 finale. The year was 1993, and in the Denver, Colorado suburb of Aurora, the city was bustling. Aurora had now amassed a population of around 200,000 people, and during this time, many people were coming from all over to start or continue their careers in one of Aurora's major industries, such as aerospace, defense, healthcare, and more. Also, for the people who moved here and for the natives alike, they could enjoy the pretty peaceful weather that came with Aurora, because a report states that the city had an average of 300 days of mild, sunny weather, with of course snow during winter. All in all, many reports state that Aurora was such a safe place to live and prosper. But on a cold winter's night in December 1993, a scary event occurred at one of Aurora's most popular event spaces for families. And in the end, it would shatter several lives. In the following case, you'll find out what event happened here, the investigation, and the ghastly aftermath in a case I title Last Shift. On the evening of December 14, 1993, many families brought their children and possibly their children's friends to the popular amusement restaurant, Chuck E. Cheese. As the restaurant was closing around 10 p.m., families packed up and left after a night of fun, and the shift of workers started their closing duties. Reports state that dishwasher 20-year-old Bobby Stevens went out to take a quick smoke break after closing. Bobby wasn't scheduled to work that evening, but because it was around Christmas and he was a new father to a newborn son, he needed the extra money and asked his bosses if he could pick up a shift. They agreed and put him to work with the dishes. Right before he was done with his break, though, Bobby heard popping noises coming from inside Chuck E. Cheese. He thought nothing of it because he thought it was probably one of the children from that night popping balloons, or one of his coworkers popping balloons to throw them away later. So Bobby headed back inside through the kitchen's back door to resume washing the dishes. But suddenly, Bobby realized that what he heard was not balloons popping. It was much worse. When just a few moments later, a tall and lanky man burst through the front kitchen door, waved a gun in Bobby's face, and shot him. The man then calmly walked back into the dining room, leaving Bobby for dead. But he wasn't. Even though Bobby was hit in his jaw, he played dead because he feared the gunman would come back and finish him. But when there was a long silence, Bobby felt the gunman was gone by this point and fled back out of the kitchen back door. He knew his coworkers were in danger, but he needed to get help. So Bobby walked to the nearby Mill Pond apartment complex and pounded on a tenant's door. When a resident answered, he asked them to call 911 because he and his coworkers had all been shot at the nearby Chuck E. Cheese, and they agreed. After the call, emergency personnel rushed to the scene to find out what exactly was going on at Chuck E. Cheese. When they did, however, they came across a sight they weren't expecting. Bloody bodies sprawled throughout the restaurant. And when they got closer, personnel thought it was eerie that while they had bodies in front of them, the animatronics from Chuck E. Cheese were still playing. And they eventually confirmed that three of the four victims were dead, with one barely clinging to life. While the critically injured employee and Bobby were rushed to the hospital, detectives immediately dived into the investigation as to who in the world could possibly do this at Chuck E. Cheese of all places, and why. Reports state that during the investigation, witnesses, including current Chuck E. Cheese employees who worked earlier that day, were questioned about anything or anyone that seemed abnormal during the opening hours, because maybe one of them had a clue as to why this tragedy may have happened. Well, reports state that detectives got information that earlier on the 14th, employees noticed that a former employee had randomly decided to come in, play some games, and dine at the restaurant at around 9 p.m. However, they also added that he was also a fired employee, and his name was Nathan Dunlap. And his victims were 17-year-old Ben Grant, 17-year-old Colleen O'Connor, 50-year-old night manager Marge Kohlberg, and 19-year-old Sylvia Crowell, who died the next day at a Denver hospital after being declared brain dead. According to reports, Nathan was a 19-year-old single man living with his mother. But reports further state his beginnings with his parents were anything but happy. Nathan was born in 1974 in Chicago, Illinois, to his mother Carol and her fiancé, Jerry Dunlap, even though Jerry was not Nathan's biological father. Jerry was a one-time short-lived professional football player who, after retiring, weighed nearly 400 pounds, and according to reports, Jerry was anything but loving to his family. Reports state Jerry would also abuse Carol, their daughter Adenia, Nathan, and later on, their youngest son Garland. After Jerry and Carol married a few months after Nathan was born, things only got worse regarding the abuse. And as Nathan grew up, he and his siblings almost didn't stand a chance against either parent. You see, reports state that Carol suffered from severe mental health struggles throughout her life, and lots of times took her struggles out on her children. She spent many times in and out of mental health facilities, and due to this, she spent lots of time away from her children. In 1974, shortly after Nathan's birth, Carol, after possibly having a mental episode, discarded Nathan in the trash. After this, Carol was sent several miles away to Waukegan, Illinois, to a facility. and due to her being sent away, her children were temporarily sent to foster care, as Jerry had left the home momentarily. By the time Nathan was 2, Carol was cleared to be released from the facility, and she regained custody of her children. Carol then moved her and the children to Michigan for a time for her to work. Then Carol moved her and the children to Colorado in 1984. However, through all of this, Carol suffered from manic mood swings and psychosis when she was off her medication. And reports state her mood swings would be so bad that Carol would use corporal violence against the children. And she would also be hypersexualized to the point where she would walk around the house naked. Also during her mood swings, she would often not sleep, staying up for days, and would move furniture around the home frequently, and would take dozens of baths in a 24-hour period. After a while, Jerry reunited with the family, and it was not a happy homecoming. Reports state Jerry continued his abuse, and this time it was more intense as the children were older. He allegedly beat Nathan and Garland on the regular, with Nathan getting most of the beatings. It's been said that Jerry even threw Nathan down some stairs, threatened to beat him with a heavy metal copy holder, beat Nathan in a Burger King bathroom, and once allegedly slammed Nathan into a locker. He also allegedly beat Nathan after he left soap in the sink after washing dishes and for eating donuts during breakfast at a hotel. Many times, Adenia would break up the beatings, but reports state she too got heavily abused by Jerry, in a different way. According to reports, Jerry would allegedly sexually abuse Adenia and threaten her not to tell anyone. The sexual abuse was frequent, and even though she tried to hide what was going on, a report states that one time Nathan witnessed this. But to protect her brother, Adenia tried to clean it up and told Nathan they were quote-unquote just playing around. After witnessing this and dealing with abuse on the daily, by the time Nathan reached middle school, he wanted to end it all. Reports state Nathan attempted suicide twice and was hospitalized for the attempts. However, every time he was sent back home after hospital stays, Jerry's abuse would not stop. By 1989, though, Adenia, now a young adult, moved out of the home, leaving Nathan, Garland, and Carol to deal with Jerry. However, around this time, Carol, despite her own battles, noticed something else with Nathan. She noticed Nathan would get angry out of nowhere, be argumentative, and sometimes retreat from socialization. Nathan would also get into behavioral trouble at school, and he had run-ins with the law, including some burglaries. In the same year, 1989, Carol wondered if Nathan was suffering from mental crisis like she was, and contacted a juvenile treatment center. Reports state that after an evaluation at the center, a psychologist suggested Nathan showed signs of a conduct or thought disorder, with another suggesting Nathan having depression. A psychologist suggested Nathan might have had an oppositional disorder related to bipolar disorder, but he was never diagnosed with an official condition except for possible hypomania, as many mental health professionals at the facility suggested due to his age, he wouldn't have bipolar disorder, as many in the mental health world at that time believed bipolar disorder symptoms didn't manifest until after puberty, usually around the age of 19 or 20. After his release from the center, Nathan continued to act out by getting arrested for numerous misdemeanors and for selling drugs. He did go on to graduate high school, but reports state Nathan worked small jobs here and there until around May 1993, when the now 19-year-old Nathan got hired as a pizza dough boy at the Chuck E. Cheese restaurant in Aurora. Nathan seemed to not have any issues at first while working here, But according to reports, in July of 1993, after being requested by his supervisor to work hours beyond his schedule, Nathan and the supervisor argued. After Nathan refused to work beyond his shift, his supervisor fired him, sending him spiraling. Reports state that after his firing, Nathan began fuming. He was angry that just because he refused to work more hours than scheduled, he was fired. He felt disrespected, and now he was out of a job. However, instead of putting energy into finding a new position, Nathan told anyone who listened about how angry he was about the firing. He would tell his friends about his anger and how he was going to kill his former supervisor and possibly rob his former place of work. He even hung around some of his former Chuck E. Cheese co-workers outside the restaurant and told them his grievances, as well as some current workers there while at the restaurant. His anger festered and festered until reaching its tipping point on the night of December 14th, 1993. According to reports, at around 9 p.m. that night, Nathan went to his former workplace, Chuck E. Cheese. When he got there, the place was somewhat busy, and he ordered a sandwich and sat at a table alone near the front. He then played an arcade game, talked to some former co-workers, then called his girlfriend. At around 9:50, 10 minutes before closing, Nathan went into the restroom and waited to play out his plan. But reports state, as he was waiting, Nathan thought to himself if he should do this, what he was planned on doing, over and over again. By the time 10 p.m. arrived, the restaurant was closed, and Sylvia Crowell began disassembling a salad bar close to the bathroom where Nathan was. When suddenly, Nathan came out of the bathroom, smiled, and shot Sylvia behind her right ear as she worked. He then approached Ben Grant, who was vacuuming, and shot him in the face near his left eye. After witnessing her co-workers get shot, Colleen O'Connor, who was performing other dining room duties, saw Nathan approach her, got on her knees, and begged for her life. She also promised she wouldn't rat him out, but Nathan smiled and shot Colleen through the top of her head. Nathan then found Bobby Stevens in the kitchen, as mentioned before, and shot him in the jaw. But thankfully, Bobby survived. He then went to the back office where Marge Kohlberg was counting money. Nathan demanded she open the safe, which she did. But then Nathan shot her in one of her ears. He then noticed Marge was still moving and then shot her through her other ear, killing her. Nathan then emptied her purse over her body, took $1,500 from the store safe, put the money in the purse, and then went back inside the dining room. There, Nathan took some Chuck E. Cheese keychains and game tokens and then fled. Reports state that Nathan went to an apartment shared by two friends who were close by. The friends counted the money, and Nathan asked one of the friends to give him an alibi. However, after the brief conversation, Nathan went to his girlfriend's home, and they had sex. While there, the next morning, Nathan called Carol, who told him she was with the police, who were looking for him. Carol then handed her phone to one of the officers, and after briefly speaking, Nathan agreed to meet with them. However, before he met with the police, he phoned someone and asked them if peroxide would remove gun residue. He then washed his hands with peroxide and then took a shower. He was then picked up by police later that day. According to reports, when questioned by police, Nathan told police he left Chuck E. Cheese around 9:20 p.m. And since they didn't have too much evidence against him, they let him go. They also interviewed multiple other witnesses, with some naming Nathan as the killer. And after a more thorough investigation via witnesses and other clues, on December 23, 1993, police had a warrant for Nathan's arrest. When they arrived to arrest him at his mother's home, reports state that Nathan directed police to a small caliber semi-automatic gun, but did not confess to the mass shooting. However, on the same day, the state of Colorado charged Nathan with 4 counts of deliberative murder, 4 counts of felony murder, attempted first-degree murder, attempted first-degree felony murder, first-degree burglary, first-degree assault, and aggravated robbery. And prosecutors announced they would be seeking the death penalty. By the time Nathan was arrested and a trial date was set, the murders at Chuck E. Cheese made national news, with the media zooming in on Aurora, and the city became a media sensation. With this, the court decided Nathan should be tried elsewhere to find a jury that might be more fair to the trial than at Aurora, and the trial was moved 60 miles away to Colorado Springs. Reports also state that as Nathan was in custody while awaiting trial, he was mostly a quiet inmate until Valentine's Day, 1994. According to reports, that day, a guard watched as he quietly read Bible passages at one moment and then ran to the window screaming obscenities at the next. Due to this, Nathan was moved into a rubber-walled room and placed on suicide watch as his meltdowns continued. He would also sometimes tear off his clothes and spread feces on his body and the walls. Nathan was eventually taken to a mental care facility where he had round-the-clock evaluations and care. To prosecutors, though, they wondered if Nathan would be able to stand trial. But the prosecutors doctor, who was to be a witness against Nathan, thought he was faking his condition just so he could be declared incompetent to stand trial. However, if that were the case, it didn't work, because by July 1994, Nathan was deemed competent to stand trial and was held in custody until his trial began on January 12, 1996. When the trial began, prosecutors, a report states, quote-unquote, had a remarkably strong case against Dunlap. They also said his motive was simple. He wanted revenge for being fired from Chuck E. Cheese, even though the supervisor who fired him was not there that day. As for evidence, for one, they brought up his violent and criminal past, including his misdemeanors, drug dealing, and robberies, in which some cases, Nathan used a golf club as a weapon and later guns. Prosecutors also talked about how, when he went to juvenile detention, he had a chance to turn his life around, but didn't. Another report states that the prosecution pointed out, quote-unquote, that since Dunlap had been in jail, awaiting trial, he had torn a leg off a metal desk, sharpened it, and began to scrape away at the window's ledge in the cell. They took pictures of Dunlap's new jailhouse tattoos. One was Crazy Horse, the new nickname he embraced. The other was a smoking handgun with the phrase, "by any means necessary." Prosecutors also mentioned to the court that Nathan confessed to fellow inmates, to a jail deputy, to friends, many of whom had testified against him in exchange for reduced sentences, and to a trusted mentor. They also called to the stand the county coroner, who demonstrated the victim's wounds by plunging knitting needle-like rods into styrofoam heads to show how a bullet moved through the skulls and brains while the prosecution lined the models on a table. They even turned on Ben's vacuum cleaner just so jurors can hear and see a reenactment of how and when he was shot. They also called to the stand several witnesses, including Carol, who pleaded the fifth, and Bobby Stevens, the lone survivor, who had a small scar on his cheek from his gunshot wound. He testified that he was very sure the person who shot him and his coworkers was Nathan. And soon after his testimony, the prosecution rested. When it was the defense's turn to defend Nathan, reports state they made several objections during the prosecution's presentation, but did not call a witness to testify on Nathan's behalf and offered no rebuttals. Nathan was said to have wanted to testify on his behalf, but his attorneys advised him against it. And by February 1996, the defense rested. Reports state that on February 26, 1996, the jury took just 3.5 hours to find Nathan guilty. After the verdict, Nathan was kept in custody until his sentencing, and when he was sentenced on May 17th of the same year, Nathan was sentenced to death plus an additional 108 years. After his sentencing, despite being nonchalant during most of the trial, Nathan had an outburst for around 3 minutes in court, saying how he didn't give a F about the judge, jury, the victim's families, and anyone else he felt wronged him. But after his outburst, he apologized to his sister Adenia and was eventually sent to Colorado's death row. In the years after his death row conviction, Nathan filed several appeals to get retried, with one appeal filed in 2008 because Nathan claimed his trial attorneys were ineffective by not presenting a defense on his mental health and abusive upbringing. But in August 2010, a judge rejected his claim, saying Nathan was fairly tried, competently represented, and justifiably sentenced to death. In April 2012, another appeal filed by Nathan's attorneys was denied after his new attorneys suggested his previous attorneys were negligent in that had the jury in his case heard about his mental health and abusive upbringing, they may have voted against the death penalty. The following year, on May 1st, 2013, a judge announced that the execution date for Nathan would be in mid-August 2013. However, days later, on May 22nd, his execution was put on hold after the then-governor decided against executing Nathan or granting him clemency. Instead, he offered a temporary reprieve, meaning as long as he stayed governor, Nathan would not likely be executed, angering his victims' families. By 2018, a new governor had been elected, and he was staunchly anti-death penalty. And in 2020, the governor signed a bill repealing the death penalty, commuting Nathan's and two other condemned inmates' sentences to life without parole. Nathan Dunlap remains in prison as of 2024, and he has since apologized publicly for his carnage. The story of the Chuck E. Cheese massacre comes from the sources of the Denver Post, Westworld, CBS News, and others I'll put in the notes. Okay, so I'm going to do a quick opinion piece, very quick. I'm not going to keep ranting, as some of you may say my opinion piece is, but I'm going to just say first, I don't know if Nathan had a mental health break I know people can get angry. I know he had been through some evaluations and been at treatment centers, but I think personally, Nathan was just upset for being fired. Now, I know lots of people, including myself, may not like being scheduled for something and then being asked to work later than scheduled, but either I'll quit, which I haven't done. I haven't quit for working more hours because that's money, in my opinion, but I may be a little upset about it, but, you know, I try to keep the peace. Nathan argued, got fired. But instead, like I mentioned, instead of putting energy into into finding another job, he just went off. He ranted to anyone who would listen about how he hated that supervisor. He wanted to kill that supervisor. He wanted to get money from the store while he was at it. Well, the restaurant while he was at it. And yeah, everyone said it was him. It came back as Nathan. He killed his former coworkers. I don't know if he actually worked with the victims, which is terribly sad because a lot of them, all of them were young. They're just making a little living, making extra money as college, well, high school students. Bobby had a newborn child. Marge was, middle-aged, but she still had family. She's making some money working as a night manager at Chuck E. Cheese, and they were all going about their business working when Nathan, who no longer worked there for months, had festered for months about killing his former supervisor when they weren't there. He's just decided to make carnage anyway, which I don't get, but that's just so sad and horrific. And like I said, I think he should have put all that energy into finding a new position rather than taking it out on his former workplace and killing all those innocent people. And that's it. I mentioned like it was going to be quick. I do want to know what you all think, but thank you for tuning in to the season 5 finale of 90s Crime Time. And I hope this story interested you for the holiday season. And that's another thing. It was so close to Christmas, and yet all these people lost their lives innocently for someone who had gotten fired months before. The supervisor wasn't even there that night, but I digress. If you liked what you heard and you haven't done so, again, I would love a rating for the show on any podcast platform you may listen to that has a rating system. Again, if you don't like the show, I still want to know. I've been trying for several seasons to get better, to please you all. I know I can't please you all, but to make things better, doing my best on the show. I hope to be better in season 6, which will be next year in January. Until then, you can also follow 90s Crime Time on social media, primarily on Instagram, where I post on other 90s cases, mostly on the weekends. And now to some announcements. I'm going to try to do more updates on Facebook going into 2025, where there's also a 90s Crime Time page. And I see you all following frequently, and I feel bad that I'm not posting on Facebook, but I aim to change that starting in January 2025. I also plan on doing more 90s Crime Time, well, story time articles on medium.com, and I'll post the link in the show notes so you can read the cases I've already written about there. Also, in 2025, I plan on putting out more 90s Crime Time merchandise via Instagram or some other platform. I'm still fishy on how I want to possibly give you all merch for 90s Crime Time. I haven't really decided that yet, but I'm probably going to give the like Instagram and Facebook or whatnot, but I'll decide that by next month, hopefully. Also, I plan on having the 90s Crime Time website back up and running in early 2025. I can't promise in January, but I will have it up hopefully in early 2025. And if I get it together by early next year, 90s Crime Time as a whole, if I still have fans of the show, I plan on exploring subscription options for 90s Crime Time via Apple and possibly Patreon, which I'm really excited about, not for money reasons, but I want to be like, you know, the podcast who gives exclusive content. I've never done that. Like, so if you're a subscriber, you can listen to episodes other listeners can't listen to until they subscribe. And I'm really excited about that. It's kind of mysterious type thing in my weird way. But I'm excited to join Patreon or Apple Podcast Premium sometime next year if I get it together. And I hope to have a regularly scheduled episode, podcast like normal. I used to be normal. But life got in the way these past few years and I've just been all over the place. But I still wanted to give you all content and I'm excited for January 2025. That's the moral of the story. With that, stay safe and healthy. Happy holidays, happy new year, and I hope to see you all in January 2025 for season 6 of 90s Crime Time.